Even His Holiness always does it. So thank you, Paula and Christopher, for inviting me to come today to talk to everyone about peace, which is something that I'm really too little familiar with myself, since I'm always restlessly rushing here and there and saying something or doing something. And unfortunately, I get too little time to take long, peaceful retreats, as you all do here all the time, which is your great good fortune and the great kindness of the people who maintain this institution, and which are you as well, I'm sure, and many others. But such institutions are, of course, much too rare in our planet, and therefore our planet is having such problems nowadays. I really literally don't really know what to talk about today. I really have no idea. I brought with me a few things. I brought His Holiness has a lovely little pamphlet printed by Wisdom Press called A Human Approach to World Peace by the Dalai Lama. And I thought I'd glance in that for some ideas, and then I began to read it, and I thought, well, maybe I should just read it. And then I brought Shantideva's, the background of His Holiness's book is Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, which is a Mahayana Buddhist text by a great 7th century Buddhist master. And his chapters on patience is considered the great patience, and his chapter on meditation, the meditation of love and compassion, are considered the two sort of loci classici, the two most important locations of the meditations of altruism and the meditations of tolerance, which are considered the crucial meditations underlying the achievement of peace. But so then I started reading that, and I thought, well, I just have to read all of that. All of that, it's about 700-800 verses. And its commentaries are vast and huge. And then I thought of following Vimalakirti and maintaining silence. Not that that would be anything new around here. But since it would be so new for me, I thought it might be a thrill, you know? Since I always talk all the time. You know? But, so it's really, I'm really puzzled as to really what is the most important and useful thing that we can think of in terms of peace, you know, and about this inner and outer thing. So maybe I'll just sort of ramble through a few points that I think are very important. Somehow, in the last year or two, it's a very odd phenomenon. I don't know, it's a post-midlife crisis or something, but I personally was a monk for 4 or 5 years. I was only ordained for about a year and a half with all the paraphernalia, you know, and with the robe and the whole trip, you know, and no food after 12 o'clock. It used to be terrible. I used to sometimes buy, cook, and eat everything in the 15 minutes before 12 o'clock. It was really barbaric, anyway. But I was very strict. And so I did that for 4 or 5 years, and then I became a layman again and married and raised children, and in the process of doing that, I decided that in the practice of the crucial practices of tolerance, of love and compassion, but especially tolerance, patience, that having children is by far more powerful yoga than being a monk. It's easy to be a monk with no one going, yeah, late at night, you know? And when you're just about to attain highest samadhi and ultimate mindfulness, and yourself is dissolving, the room is becoming empty space, and you're feeling really pleased with yourself that you're doing a great yoga there, suddenly, some smell starts to come up, you know. You have to go and clean the bottom, you know. So that's real tolerance and real patience, you know, and real non-duality, actually, is to develop a meditation that can sustain that. So I got into a thing where I sort of idealized the lay life and the non-duality of the lay life, and trying to maintain a state of concentration and compassion, trying to deroutinize one's emotional reactions and somehow maintain a calm and peacefulness in the middle of activity. I got into a big thing on that. And I happened to be asked by someone to translate the Vimalakirti Sutra, which some of you may know, which is also very much focused on non-duality. Vimalakirti is a layman and provides a certain type of lay ideal for the practicing Buddhist in the middle of the world type of thing. But then, about 5 years ago, or maybe, I suddenly rediscovered monasticism from a different angle entirely. And I discovered that it really fit in the history of this planet as a very crucial institution. And it made it fit as a very important, Buddhism's, of course, most important and most powerful institutional contribution to world history. And this was kind of funny. Dalai Lama giggled and laughed at me when I was just, when we had some conversations in 79 and 80, when I was in the beginning to really get into this. He laughed and he said, "Oh, here's Mr. Ex-monk. He loves monasteries now." He said, "Now that there's no danger of his joining one." And we joked about it, but then we realized that he explained to me that actually the upasika, the upasika, the female or male lay ordained person in Buddhism traditionally, is in some sense a part of the monastery, though also attached to a family. And actually, traditionally, there's some sense in which it's considered to be more difficult to be a lay person, an ordained lay person, and sort of maintain worldly responsibilities and support a monastic community, both. And in a sense, then they have these, Tibetans have these wonderful things. These come from India, they're not Tibetan. I think they have them in Southeast Asia too. They have the monk for a day vow, monk or nun for a day vow. You take it in the morning at dawn from your preceptor, and then you're a monk all day, and then it dissolves when the night falls, and you can be a layman again, or a laywoman. But you could, of course, in a retreat, you could do it every day for 2 or 3 months. So you could practice being a monk that would be somehow terminal, short, experimental monk or nunhood. So they have various ways in which the lay people are involved with the monastic community. And so that is more what I'm working on now. And somehow in my connection with, fairly often I go to meetings or conferences where people are talking about sort of Buddhist institutional issues, and people in Zen centers and people in Vipassana centers and people in Tibetan various kinds of centers are wondering whether or not they should, you know, do something active. But then they feel guilty. Well, if they do that, then they get all hepped up, you know, and they've been feeling very calm and peaceful, and then they get out onto the picket line in front of the nuclear submarine and they become enraged with Caspar Weinberger, who is committing, like by building all these multi-billion dollar useless pieces of destructive machinery, is causing the starvation and death of millions and millions and millions of people. And when people begin to develop that consciousness and realize that, they become enraged. And then they feel guilty. Uh-oh, back to samadhi. Whoops, watch my rage. Sit back down, watch that rage. You know? So, which is excellent that they withdraw then, and because, of course, rage, even righteous rage, is still rage. It still adds to the sea of poison that is causing all of this trouble. And so you know that you're not really ready to engage on that level when you do become enraged and righteously indignant. In fact, righteous indignation is considered the acid test in the Tibetan tradition of vipassana, of lagtong, what they call, which is vipassana. It is supposed to be the time when you are wrongly accused of something by someone, or in a family squabble, you are in the right, or in whatever issue, and someone is wrongly attacking you. You know, you did this wrong and that wrong and something, and then at that time, you can then see how good your ego habit is under some sort of control, how much transcendence you really have. That's the time to see, they say. Because when the I rises feeling righteous, you know, I want to save the world. I don't want bombs. I want people to live. Then if the I is coming out a little too strongly, if it's gripping your solar plexus, a little twisting, a little too tight, then you know that you have not made a great deal of progress, actually. Even though you have all good ideas, and even though you've had moments of peace that you've achieved, you know you haven't made great progress when the I can mobilize this gripping, choking feeling sort of from the midriff up to the throat. I, you know, it just clamps in there, you know, and you feel miserable. And you feel that the only way to get rid of this misery is to get rid of this thing that is causing it outside there, which is the nuclear bomb, let's say. Or the idea that someone would want to would risk destroying all life. The other day in one of my classes, I was debating with a student, day before yesterday, debating with a student who was upholding materialism as a useful idea. And I pretty much cornered him that this, his notion that he was nothing really, and that his subjectivity was an illusion, and that at death he would go scot-free of all consequences of all of his acts done during life, and that because he would become nothing at death, and that that was a position that led him to be not too disturbed about participating in extremely inhumane interpersonal, socio-political, etc. arrangements. And that, because after all, if he had a really bad headache, he could just kill himself and he would be anesthetized. And if somebody else really hurt badly, they could just be killed and they would be anesthetized. They would be put out of their misery, as they say. And he was pretty cornered on that. I'm looking a little bit upset about it. And he was tallying by how much atrocities religious people have done, which was a very good counter. And we are about to get into that when another fellow leaped up suddenly and just irately said to him, "You wouldn't mind if all life on Earth was destroyed in a nuclear holocaust?" And then everybody suddenly startled, because this guy who had the right, who was saying the right thing, was so passionately gripped in this. And I'm afraid I rather horrified him. He felt rather betrayed. When I said the true peace activist should be able to remain calm at such a prospect, even. Should, in fact, if they see someone who has a button in their hand, a bad guy, you know, like Reagan or Weinberger or some of the other bad guys, General so-and-so in the Kremlin, that they somehow do not feel that that person is any different from them. And they can realize by being able to identify that that person really is them, and that they can realize that actually they themselves could be a mass killer. They have it in their own, as long as they have not transcended all of self-habits. It is possible for anyone to get into a position where they would be willing to see tremendous destruction or cause it. None of us are exempt from that. And there may, of course I shouldn't say, there may be those saints among you who are true arihatas, arhats, who have destroyed their enemies, their inner enemy of the self-habit, and who couldn't possibly get angry no matter what happened to them. And if there are those among you, you do know who you are. And if there are none such among you, you also know that, because you can remember last time you got really mad. Because when that I feeling, that choking I feeling arises in a sense of righteousness, then it will push us to do anything, because at that time we have lost our free will. We are being under the control of our I habit, of our anger at that time. And you know, people who are angry, it's not, you can't even be mad at them that they want, as Santideva says, you can't be mad that an angry person wants to harm you, or kill someone else. A person who is mad with anger will kill themselves without even noticing. You know, they'll drive their car into a wall, you know. The I thinks it's so absolute and so powerful when it arises fueled with righteous rage that, you know, you'll have charges of the light brigade. You know, the I will just pay no attention to the body and bones and flesh of the being it happens to be carrying around with it, which might be you, you know. If you're the angry one, you know. It's the anger will just carry you around. It will fling your body into a fire or into anything. Human beings are very amazingly self-destructive. So should it be any wonder that we can be very other-destructive? And therefore, if we have such an idea, then even what we perceive as an evil person is a human being like us. And therefore, We then can be engaged in true intervention or peace work with them if we, at the same time, forgive them, in a sense. At the same time as we may forcefully oppose them, we have to be forgiving of them. We have to feel identified with them in some way. Anyway, these are the yogas. These are the yogas of Shantideva. But these are the individual things, in fact, you know, the individual control of mind, not only seeing through the false linkage such as Vipassana's main objective is to see through, of course, the root of all suffering in the world, which is the false linkage behind the self-habit, the way in which all of our reactions are falsely oriented around a seeming absolute core of self, which does not in fact exist, and the perception of its failure to exist on the part of our living, changeable self is freedom, as defined in all kinds of Buddhism. And in particular, Vipassana is that seeing through, which Vipassana means, Vipassana, seeing between or seeing through, literally. Passana means to see, or Passana in Pali. And V means by dividing, by penetrating. So Vipassana means seeing through. So it means particularly seeing through this facade of the ego organization. With the ego organization, of course, because anything you do in some sense is organized in some way. But even that, and that is the role of that, and that is crucial, of course, to achieving peace. We have to achieve peace within in order to achieve peace without, no question. And not only that, but at least in the Tibetan tradition, for example, in this book, one of His Holiness's main points is that compassion is a pillar of world peace. People have to understand that compassion is a pillar of world peace. But compassion should never be taken to make one feel badly or guilty of being on a retreat doing vipassana or vipassana, laktong, seeing through one's false ego organization, seeing the illusoriness of it. It should never make one feel guilty. In fact, it should intensify that kind of seeing through yoga. Because genuine compassion is indivisible from the wisdom that is the result of that seeing through yoga. Any compassion short of having seen through the illusion of the ego process is going to be tinged with what they call in the tradition sentimentality, you could say, with notional love, what they call notional love. And therefore, it will be ineffectual in some way because it will fail to see the solution. It will see the unhappiness of the being. Compassion, of course, on the very simplest level means awareness of the grief and suffering of others, and a wish and a willingness to take it off them, a wish for them to become free of it, is fundamentally how compassion is defined. But if you don't know what a state of happiness is, if you don't know that all beings can only really become happy by becoming free of their hypnotism, free of their thraldom to the ego organization delusion, that when you see people with a certain look on their face, charging through life, looking for something, unless you realize that what they're really looking for is freedom from identifying with the one who is looking, that's what they're really looking for, then you can't really help them. You might think what they're looking for is some food, it might be some house, it might be some meditative state, it might be some kind of fame, or it might be some kind of pleasure. None of these things, but they will, if you give them all of those things, they will be dissatisfied with them right away. They'll enjoy for a minute and gobble it down, and then they'll want another one. They'll think, oh, I got this famous now, but then they'll want more. They'll be dissatisfied. Oh, so-and-so is still more famous than me. No good. Someone such as a bigger guru than me, or such thing like that. They'll be annoyed again right away. Because actually what everyone is looking for is to break through the sense of drivenness that is inevitable upon being a prisoner of the false, what's called the iron cage, what Tsongkhapa calls the iron cage of the self-habit, of self-clinging, of self-grasping, like an iron cage, a prison. So therefore, the compassion that wants them to be free, while it will be a good sentiment, it will be ineffective because it won't have a sense of what it is that really makes beings happy. So therefore, there should be no duality between the drive for compassion as the essential energy of world peace, as His Holiness says, the very fabric, love and compassion as the very fabric of world peace, and the intention to see through the false way of organizing the self, to see through the self-habit, to realize one's freedom. And of course, we should be very careful never to say to see through the ego, or to see through the self, lose the self or lose the ego. The nice thing about Buddha Dharma is there's no need to lose any ego. There's no aim at any state of egolessness. This is a nice idea. There is an aim at the realization of selflessness. This must be very technically looked at. A realization is something which cannot be even appropriate even by Buddha without a Buddha having an ability to realize that I, the Buddha, have realized selflessness. So egolessness would be a kind of dysfunctional state, and we surely don't want to think that our arhats, our saints, and our Buddhas, and our highest ideals are, you know, schizoid or psycho. They don't know what I refers to. They go, I have to go to the bathroom or something. They don't know who they're talking about. They sort of wet themselves. We don't want to put enlightened beings in a state of not being able to function. This is like a mistake that is very typical. It's why, for example, Western psychological people are so suspicious of the Dharma. They're worried, or their sons and daughters or their friends or their patients are going out there and meditating. And from the psychological people in psychology say, gee, they're trying to become nobody. They're trying to lose their ego. We're going to have a lot of victims on our hands here. It's very important that recognize that the healthy ego is the Buddha ego, is the Arhat's ego. It is an ego that is aware of its illusoriness. It is, I thought of it this morning, it's not a nobody. Buddha and Arhats are not nobodies. This is very important to recognize. So if we can go around and simulate acting like we are nobody, we'll be very holy and saintly. We shouldn't get trapped in that idea. Or if we see someone who's a good actor and can pretend nicely to be nobody. When they do like that, we shouldn't be taken in about that. Because Buddhas are definitely not nobody. Buddhas, arhats, are beings who are not full of themselves, and therefore they're full of concern for others automatically. If you empty your concern about yourself, if you look through the center of yourself and found nothing there, really there, and except, of course, you're looking and seeing the freedom from something being there is still you, a living you, then you automatically, you sort of, it's like a, you look through and you see beyond, see through, you become transparent to yourself and you see everybody else. And when you see everybody else, you're immediately concerned. They become all your children. They become all your mother and your father. They become everything that you love. You want them to be happy. Why not? You don't even see. You also, of course, see through them, too. It's very crucial that they also become transparent. Because if you become transparent from yourself, everyone projects on others and see them as a reflection of themselves. Someone who's very self-involved sees others as very self-involved. Therefore, they become very cynical. They think others are out to get them because they're out to get others. So when someone doesn't find themselves, when they really look in vipassana, samadhi, then they don't find anybody else either. But yet they realize that everyone is there in the same way which they are still there, free of really being there. So I was thinking, it's not that a Buddha and Arhat is a nobody, it's that the Buddha and Arhat is some sort of a nobody, some kind of a nobody. So some kind of a nobody is still responsible for being some kind of something. It's just that they can't get too self-important, and they're automatically other-important. They think others are important. They're automatically altruistic. So this quest for selflessness, which is vipassana, should never be put in contradiction with compassion, because it is the source of compassion. It's the fire, it's the heat, it's the generator of compassion. Without achieving insight selflessness, you cannot manifest ethical selflessness genuinely. And without seeing through others, you cannot help them see through themselves, which is what they really need and want. So this is the individual thing, but I don't want to go on about that. I don't mean to go on about that. Shantideva goes on about that in the most beautiful way in his eighth chapter and sixth chapter. Patience chapter and meditation chapter. Because I want to touch on this institutional issue, because I feel that's so important when we're thinking in terms of a movement. Now, I read an article by an old-timer who is an old-time person in the peace movements in the United States, who's a scholar at Columbia, an economist, I think. His name is Melman. Some of you may know of him. Recently, criticizing the American peace movement. And he is a member of it, but he was being critical of it. And he was saying that, for example, people who are in the peace movement of the 80s don't even know the history of the peace movement of the 50s, which was a big movement. Because at that time, there was a big build-up. There was a lot of bomb scare. There was like air raid sirens up and down every corner. And there were people were digging shelters in the yard, you know. they were handing out shovels type of mentality was going on after the first Russian nuclear test. And there was also a peace movement. And his critique was that the peace movements are great. They really get outraged at a certain point. They really get wound up, and they get out, and they really protest. And then every once in a while, they do stop something. They stop, they feel that, you know, people pretend that they were stopped in their Vietnam Wars, or in their procurement of this weapon, or in this and that. They made this and that deal because of this pressure of the peace movement. And they're certainly aware of it. But what he pointed out was that what then happens is then the peace movement people, because what they're doing is sort of an extraordinary kind of thing, not really part of their normal lives in a way, it's something extraordinary like to save the planet, they sort of all go home and they think, great, we turned off that B-1, we stopped the war, whatever, you know. And the people on the other side who are buying and making and using the weapons, they don't go home. They're paid salaries. They're part of an institution that does not cease. They just go back to the drawing boards. I mean, they are paid to operate these drawing boards, and they hire all the best talent in the country, in particularly this country, to go to those drawing boards. And they do nothing but draw engines of destruction and make plans for their procurement and give out big contracts for their manufacture. And the peace movement people are sitting home happily, knitting and meditating, and feel that they've stopped something. But then the question comes, all right, so then if you follow that critique of his, and then he lists in this appendix, this like $53 billion, the B-1 program, to $45 billion, the aircraft carriers. It's a horrendous long list. And I believe the UN, I was reading Gabriel Garcia Marquez's speech to some group in South America, that it would cost $100 billion only to make sure that every child in the whole planet was properly fed permanently. And there would be no more of these starving children. It would only cost $100 billion. And this procurement list that Melman published was $255 billion, I think, just for next year or something. I forgot exactly. I'm sure you all know these figures better than me. I'm one of the worst examples of the sort of semi-peacenik who goes home and meditates, thinks that something nice has happened. So, but then you think, well, what sort of institutions do we try to put up against this? And you have our sort of distrust of institutions in general and all sorts of problems about institutions. How do we counter this in a more sustained way? What is the counter for this war movement? And then if we look back in history, where has there been an effective institutional counter for a war movement? Of course, we realize that the other nation's war movement are counter for this nation's war movement, and this nation's for the other. So each war movement itself is countering another set of institutions. So where's the counter for the whole thing? Where do you find it in history? Guess what? I found what is known as the Arya Sangha, the holy community, the community of the selfless ones. Now, to us, that sounds like a sort of mystical thing, like maybe they congregate in the astral plane on the full moon or something, and otherwise, forget it, in the West. But if you look into the history of more civilized nations than our Western nations, although we're now just getting into the threshold of it, maybe. But if you look into the older, more civilized nations of Eurasia, you find the Arya Sangha, the monastic community. This can be, in funny, the two major monastic traditions are Buddhism and Christianity. There's no wonder that you're here in a Christian, originally built building. Because Buddha was a king, right? Buddha was brought up until the age of 29 as a West Pointer in his country. You have to realize that. He was not also a dropout or a flunky. He was a very good West Pointer. It was said that when Devadatta rushed at Buddha to beat him up in the tournament, you know, the sort of football game, Buddha like flicked him over out of the stadium with one hand. He took an elephant and flicked it like 7 miles. Of course, they exaggerate. But he flicked an elephant with his toe. Devadatta, his cousin, killed the elephant with one punch, and he, Buddha, then flicked the carcass out of the... because nobody could pick up this huge elephant. So he was a tremendously effective West Point type. That means he was brought up in all the theories of Indian kinship, kingship, social administration, warfare, you know, martial arts, whatever they taught the kshatriyas, the warriors in ancient India, which was quite a lot. They were not at all a bunch of vegetarian yogis in those days. They were a bunch of rough and tough chariot fighters. They beat up Alexander the Great easily. The Indians were very tough. And so the Buddha was trained that way, and the Buddha did not just really abandon his nation. He said to his father, look, I'll run the nation. Sure, I'll run the nation. But it's just that you have to give me the proper, you know, ways of handling the main problems of the people of the nation. If I'm going to be a king, I'm not going to just be a wimpy, ineffective king. And therefore, Dad, if you want me to run the nation, teach me how to help my people overcome birth, old age, suffering, and death. Then I'll run the administration. But we have to have a department of death, department of birth, welfare department. If you don't have the answers to those real problems, then don't give me this, you know, like Bureau of Agriculture. And he left. And then he went and meditated, and he figured out how to conquer death. And he figured out, and he came back to the kingdom. He came back to the people. It was not a question. He wasn't worried, should I stay and retreat or should I go and do something for the nation? He had nothing more to retreat about. He had seen through himself. He was a piece of a walking hologram, a holographic projection of millennia of karma. He realized he wasn't really there, so he had nothing to fuss over. So he better get help other people stop fussing. So therefore, what did he organize to deal? But now as he looked around, he saw all of his contemporaries were doing what? They were into an arms race. They were having a total arms race. The king of Magadha and the king of Vaishali and the king of Kosala and the king of Kaushambi and the king of... They were all having an arms race at that time, building their chariots and spears and arrows. So what did he say? Well, I can't, if I go and join... One thing I could do, he thought, I could become again king of Shakya. His dad would have had him back in a minute. Hey, son, I'm glad you stopped wasting your time out there in the woods and you're back in business. Hey, you've grown a weird thing on top of your head. That's okay. If you're the king, nobody will say anything. Dare say anything. Run the kingdom now and fulfill your prophecy. Remember, Buddha's prophecy was either he would become a world-conquering monarch or he would become a Buddha, remember? And Dad was into the former, not the latter. So he thought, well, I could therefore become a king of this country, make it more powerful, and force everybody to be peaceful by force. But he realized that would not last well. That would not do well. There would always be someone who would see him as an enemy, and they would have use him as an excuse for an arms race of theirs, so that would actually not work. So what could he do? But he founded another kind of army. And what sort of army was that? That was an army of, do you think it was an army of wimps? Some monks and nuns who would say, don't catch us? No. It was an army of arhats and Mrs. and Mr. Arhats. Not just Mr. Arhats. An arhat means one who has conquered, actually, literally, one who has killed. The language is very tough language. One who has killed their enemy. That is, one who has killed their inner enemy of their egocentric, deluded self. Self-habit. Who has become free of their self-centered habit. And that means one who has, that's pretty heavy language. Therefore, one who fears no outer enemy. And Buddha thought, this is going to work, this peace army, army of peace that I'm establishing. It'll work on this planet. Why? Well, how is it that an army wins? Its soldiers are trained to risk their lives for their cause. You cannot beat an army that is willing, as we saw in Vietnam. You cannot beat an army where everybody will die rather than give up. That you cannot win a war like that. Even surprisingly small country, you can't beat. So therefore, in the peace army are people who are want to die rather than allow suffering. They're willing to die rather than be egocentric. They're willing to give their life for enlightenment, for insight. It's a life and death business. Therefore, monks and nuns in Asian ancient time, they adopted these certain symbols. That's what the shaving of the head means. It's a kind of way of dying. You know, you shave head of a corpse. You shave head of a soldier. They always had crew cuts, you know, like, you know, the marine cut. It's always the case in ancient time as well. And you shave a head of a monk. You give up your ordinary name and you take a different kind of a name. You go through a kind of death rebirth ceremony to indicate that you have died into the world. You don't own any property. You don't even originally, as a monk or a nun, you do not accept donation of food for tomorrow. Only what you can eat at this time. And you have to be willing to not get anything tomorrow in case nobody was wanting to give it to you. And this army that he founded, somehow, at a time when the tyrants of Greece were giving Socrates hemlock cola, when Confucius was getting kicked out from country to country, and no dukes and no rulers and no generals were letting him loose to give people education and enlightenment, somehow the Buddha founded this counter-force, the monastic force. And therefore, this force was so, and don't think it wasn't powerful. Imagine, I have no time, but imagine the history of Central Asia just, or even Japan or Korea. These were warrior peoples. Particularly the Tibetans, for example, in the 6th and 5th century, they conquered China, they conquered down to the Ganges, they conquered in Central Asia the Silk Road area, they beat up on that Baghdad of the Caliph of Baghdad, what was his name? Harun al-Rashid, who never was beaten by anybody, supposedly according to Westerners, but actually the Tibetans beat him. The Tibetans were the only nation he ever made a treaty with on equal terms, Harun al-Rashid. They were very tough. When they beat their enemies, they would, you know, like kill everybody and take no prisoners. They were really like savage people. Within 3 centuries, they were sitting in a bunch of monasteries saying, "Om mani padme hum," and being beaten up by others. They unilaterally disarmed because they were conquered by this peace force, this sangha, the nonviolent, the army of peace. You know, not just individuals of peace, uninstitutionalized, get out and say, be peaceful, put their bleed on something, stand in front of a tank, do something like that, and then leave because no organization. But professional people, whole institution, whole sangha, whose lives are given to that. This is then the effective army of peace. What I want to suggest is, so in Tibet then, after 3 centuries, they did this. The Tibetans then went, and guess who they tamed in their history? They're most proud of who they tamed, as they call it. This, the Buddhist language is tamed. Vinaya, the word Vinaya means to tame. The same word Vinaya that is in the Tripitaka, you know, the Buddhist Bible, Buddhist canon, means the discipline of how to tame people. It's the same word used for to tame a horse or to tame an ox, Vinaya. It means you can lead it away, actually. Vinaya means to lead something away. So to submit to the Vinaya, to achieve conformity with the Vinaya discipline of Buddhist Sangha, the institution of Buddhism, means that someone can lead you away. Or rather, your enlightened self can lead away your egotistical self. Let's make it self-applied. Like a tame horse, you know, doesn't buck and kick, you know, and bite. But it's led away, it does something useful. And the Tibetans considered, most proud of in their own history, that they tamed the Mongolians. This came very graphically home to me once. I was working in where I first went to study Buddhism in the Mongolian community with some young Mongolians who had the typical Mongolian physique, which is about 6 feet tall and about 6 feet wide. And they had these long, you know, 22-ounce hammers. And we were working framing a temple. And as we were working, now and then I would have this experience that a 20-penny nail would be just sort of ticked up on a beam next to my head. And this hammer would come whistling like a golf club, and whap, it would put the nail in one shot. And then I just had like sort of, you know, subconscious, I was aware of subconscious imagery of Genghis Khan, you know, and ancient times, and European-like, racist-like fears, and so forth. And I sort of thought if there was an axe or a war axe in that hand, and thank you, Buddha. They had the same feeling about Whitey me, too, by the way. We discussed it at lunch. We both thanked the Buddha. Had we been locked in age-old tribal conflicts, it would have been a terrible thing. And now the issue may be indeed. Now, finally, in Buddhist terminology too, for example, in Buddhist history, if you ever read the histories of Buddhism, they consider that Buddhism is not present in a nation. They consider a nation a barbarian nation without the presence of Buddhism, which is natural. So it's a little bit chauvinist on their part. But what they mean by Buddhism, though, really is a certain kind of nonviolent way of living, a nonviolent ethic that is really embodied in the nation. And what is the criteria of when it is there, when enlightenment is? Let's not use Buddhism because it sounds like a set of ideologies, which it isn't really. Let's use enlightenment. And the criteria is when a nation has the Sangha, when it has monasticism, when it has Dharma books and teaching and wandering teachers, that is not, enlightenment has not reached that nation. When it has some icons of the Buddha, it has not reached. When some people are doing some individual practice, it has not reached. In the historical criterion. When the nation gives the institution tax deduction, when free land, when free food, when free time and manpower and woman power is given to the institution dedicated to nothing but the individuals making peace in their own minds and hearts, with no external product. Nothing. It has no fee. It does not go out and farm. It doesn't. At different times, like in nations like in China, which was less tamed, in fact, the Zen people went out and farmed because they didn't want to depend upon the kingdom. But that's not because that was better. That was because the kingdom was not enlightened enough. The Chinese tyrants were too despotic. And they knew they would be too insecure if they didn't work. So they broke the original Vinaya rule, which was that the monks and nuns show their willingness not to live on a planet that does not acknowledge peace as its highest value, therefore put their life on the line for peace, a clear sign of that, but they were unwilling to work to support themselves. Their work was an inner work of self-transcendence, of the Dharma. There was the outer work they would not participate in. This was a very important thing in the case of India, and it wasn't followed in China for only political reasons, not other reasons. So, therefore, my appeal always is in the Buddhistic peace movement, Buddhist peace fellowship, Buddhist peace movement, whatever, you know, nowadays. It seems to, or I wouldn't say always is, it sounds, God, it sounds like I'm ready for the embalmer. My appeal is tending to be nowadays, I note, whenever I get started, is to appeal to people to recognize the crucial importance of this institution. And this means, now this institution, for example, is very much in the line of this Sangha. Yet still, it's not quite. In other words, this institution is not, I'm not sure that every member of the whole large family that is this institution would be, for example, willing to support 50 useless monks and nuns who were formerly useless. And they were proud that they were supporting these 50 useless monks and nuns. And I mean useless in a sort of worldly sense. You know, there's this importance, we're getting something out of it. We're getting something back from them. But just willing to support them for the intrinsic fact that what they do is more important, actually, than all of the worldly economic activity, all of the arrangements and rearrangements and unarrangements, that the work of self-transcending one's own heart is the work of human life. That is the purpose of all of our lives. And so if we can do some of it ourselves, sometimes good. If we can support people who want to do that with their whole lives, better as well. So I'm not sure that that's quite understood fully, and the way I would like to have it thought of, and now we'll stop, I'll stop and we'll deal with some questions. Maybe some of you will want to disagree, which I hope so. But to consider this fact, that is the key activism. You know, we talk about doing something active, we talk about social change, we talk about changing this insanity. Well, to create, to support and create institutions where sanity is going on. That is, people are changing their own heart from knotted to open, from selfish to loving. That we consider that the burgeoning, the mushrooming of such organizations in cooperation with the Christians who have many but are usually quite unmanned and unwomaned. I mean, there are very few relatively. They're very empty, those that are. And we see that the transforming of this landscape in that way is like a crucial activism. It is creating, therefore, a kind of counterforce institution, counterforce community, counterforce bureaucracy, a peace army with monks and nuns versus wax and waves and marines and soldiers. And they will not go home because their home is homelessness. Their home is the front line of the peace struggle. So it's a kind of oriental activism, the creation of the Sangha. It is a real socially revolutionary and transformative action. If you study its history in early India, you will recognize this. And it may be very well the most revolutionary thing that one could do in modern America or Europe. Japan, when the government wanted to take everybody and put them into sort of worldly production and modern mimic the Western societies, the first thing the government did was empty the monasteries. They smashed the monasteries. They recognized they would never get their country going on a materialistic, secularistic, violent, nationalistic, imperialistic path if the monasteries remained powerful institutions in their country. The monasteries are like stones for a dictator to move. They like keep the people oriented to timeless goals and values rather than let's conquer Korea. And they have people who are ready to die rather than allow some idiot general to strut around and think he's all important. And so the government just emptied those monasteries. They just stopped them. And then they turned to this horrible business they did from 1867 until 1945. And still, there are many monasteries there, but they're empty. They have married people living in them. They have they watch TV and stuff. I mean, they're beautiful. They keep their icons and they're beautiful. But there's one or two where they practice, basically. So if America was to do this today, if the movement, peace, enlightenment, Buddhist, Christian, doesn't matter. Buddhist, let's not make it some sort of alien set of ideas. Let's just see it as the Enlightenment stream. If they were to do that, it would be the only place on the planet where that type of transcendentalistic activism would be taking place, will be taking place. So anyway, I hope we do it. Thank you. And some questions. There might be some questions, you said, Paula. We should save it. We have another, we have only a couple minutes. Maybe there may be some questions. Yes. But
it's not an opposition, but since there is, as you have recognized, there is a sense of urgency in what Seymour Millman said about the peace movement, I think
right.
Is very true. And since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., interestingly enough, presented as his model also the beloved community to his movement and to his followers, would it not be, I don't want to say equally important, but certainly for us to try to create a movement that is not necessarily made up of monks and nuns and so on, but a movement that is deeply permeated by the spirit that you suggest. And if so, in some way we're trying to do it here this weekend, but in an ongoing, serious, focused, even in the best sense of the word, structural, organizational way, do you have any
Right. Well, thank you for that comment. And yes, I certainly do. In other words, the monastic anchor is like an anchor, I see it as. It's like a core. It's like a beachhead, that you use a military metaphor, which they have in their language. It's a kind of beachhead. And it puts this sort of reality that is beyond reality within the middle of the social reality. It creates, therefore, a free space. And it's like a counter boot camp. You know, like where you have, you know, because the other side, for example, they are drafting people or they are getting volunteers through commercials into their boot camps, and they're completely making their knotting up their nervous system in a Wilhelm Reichen kind of idea. They're armoring off their sensitivity to suffering and pain. They're making them willing to obey orders and act inhuman and do atrocities on people. I mean, they are actively educating in the most forceful manner, 6 months of rigid shut off this person's feeling, you know? You know, the Wilhelm Reich type of thing, like put their groin back, choke off their diaphragm, put their throat up tight, you know, beat on them and make them so they don't feel anything. And then they'll go out and be inhuman when you give the order. Okay, now that's what you're up against. You're up against this kind of disciplined, trained institution. So I'm saying that the monastic one, where those who are sort of equally gung-ho in the other direction, who feel that they have to go all the way, you know, they can't sort of keep a foot in here and there, they have to sort of go into a boot camp kind of reality, a boot camp of nonviolence, a boot camp of quest of enlightenment, is necessary as an anchor. But between that now, there is what I call, I have a sort of slogan, it's a chapter of a book I'm working on, which is on this subject, which is called Cool Heroism. And what I wish the masters and teachers here could do is begin to experiment with a yoga that combined Vipassana type insight practice, which is with Gandhian type of willing to face like the man with a club in your face, with Shantideva, you know, Mahayana type of don't hate your enemy, but actually worked on as a kind of yoga, not just the injunction of love your enemy, but the whole set of insights related to changing, reconditioning yourself, to recognizing your enemy as a helper in dealing with your greater enemy, which is your own anger. And so on, this beautiful stuff that Shantideva teaches, how to see, for example, when your enemy is attacking you, how to use your Vipassana ability to see through the facade of reality and see that, like, say your enemy is attacking you with a club. So you're not angry with the club. You don't hate the club. You don't feel mad at the club. You're mad at the man. But that's because you didn't see through the man. You're identifying that man as sort of an agent of this action. But actually, the agent of the action is the anger in that man's mind. The anger is using the man like a club who is then holding a club. And so there's two removes from you. The real problem is the anger itself. And so when you see it's the anger, then your sense of anger is equally to blame with his anger. And that's a kind of very interesting yoga that Shantideva, for example, and other teachers developed in ancient India, which brings the kind of insight type of seeing through discipline into interaction with other people. And so you have kind of a Gandhian, Shantidevian kind of workshops, training sessions what is called cool heroism, to cultivate cool heroes and cool heroines. So that, for example, the coming demonstration at the Seabrook, at the Pentagon, at the this and that, and it may be in front of Russian soldiers someday, we don't know. It could be like, you know, Fuji Guruji used to take people out in Manchuria in front of the lines. He used to take his monks. So he was first well known in the 30s. So it might be that this kind of, to train ourselves to be such a cool heroes, where we can be equally devil may care, willing to die, you know, laugh in the face of the enemy out of coolness, lovingness, and joyfulness, just as the enemy, that is the militarists of this planet, whether they be American or Russian or whatever, their key is that they are all rigided out where they're willing to die in hatred. They have to get heated up on nationalism, chauvinism, hatred, those horrible people, just genocide them, let's get them, the gooks or the whites or whatever it is they're saying, and they can get all hot, and then they don't mind getting a bullet in their leg or they don't even feel it when it goes through their ear. So hot heroism is what they're training, hot heroes. Can't we figure a way of training cool heroes? Institutionally, I'm saying, you know, can't the movement get systematic about it? Take the systematic addressing of the mind's derangement that you have in the Vipassana, for example, tradition, and its many institutions, that systematic analysis, and connected to a Gandhian type of like ideal of the, remember Gandhian's three ranks of resisting evil, remember, three ways of reacting to evil: surrender, violent heroism, and nonviolent heroism, and the highest and the most difficult, and that requiring the greatest training, the greatest self-cultivation was the nonviolent heroism. So this area, I hope, people will develop. And I'm trying to help sort of just write a little software, you know. I've never been good on hardware. I'm too retiring, actually, although I make a loud noise. In fact, I run away from these things. So I hope that this kind of institution, in other words, that this will naturally be integrated with it. But I feel that in order to create this in a large-scale, systematic way, there are certain kind of like, you know, shock troops, you know. Like the Green Berets of the nonviolent army are the monks and nuns, are going to be the monks and nuns, I feel. And so the point is, they should be honored. They should be a place for them. And really, in America, in the West, we don't really have a place for them. We don't, because of the Protestant underpinnings of American culture, we don't quite understand it. We sort of think that when we see the movie with Audrey Hepburn being the nun, we're sort of hoping she's going to get out of there, you know, go to the disco before the movie's over. We kind of, we have that feeling. We think it's kind of useless, and we want everything to have a use. And I hope I've made that uselessness to appear to for you to consider that it may be of the highest, supremest use, actually, ultimately, in all its glorious uselessness. Okay, sorry, right over the time.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
I'm having a hard time stopping you, and also feeling the elbow.
I know, it's terrible. Nina struggles with that all the time. She just tells me to shut up.
Please don't shut up.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.